Welcome once again to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thanks for tuning in. Today's program will include a piece about the use of AI for diagnosing diabetic retinopathy from Nature, and from the Braille Monitor, a response to Donald Trump's attempt to blame January's aviation accident near Washington National Airport on disabled employees at the Federal Aviation Administration. We'll also hear an article from the New York Times marking the passing of Flo Fox, a renowned street photographer who overcame blindness and paralysis, as well as other news items touching on disability issues. First, here are some items of local interest. From the city of Scottsdale, a new Disability Advocate Award opportunity is part of the Mayor's Ability Awards. This is by Holly Peralta, Public Affairs Supervisor at the City of Scottsdale. This was published March 4, 2025. Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski is proud to introduce a new award as part of the upcoming Mayor's Ability Awards, an annual program honoring the perseverance and accomplishments of individuals thriving while navigating life with disabilities. Scottsdale students are invited to apply for the awards, through which scholarships are awarded to college and trade school-bound students with physical and neurodiversities. The deadline for nominations is March 28th. The scholarship recognizes students who have shown exceptional resilience in overcoming challenges and who demonstrate a strong commitment to furthering their education. The program is led by Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski's office and sponsored through a partnership with the Gila River Indian Community. A notable addition this year is the creation of the Community Disability Advocate Award, which is an effort to celebrate the volunteers, business leaders, and nonprofit heroes working daily to make sure all who live, work, and play in Scottsdale are celebrated for their efforts. A community disability advocate is someone who actively supports individuals with disabilities by providing valuable information, guidance, and advocacy for their rights. These advocates work to raise awareness, ensure safety, promote inclusion, and foster acceptance of people with disabilities in every facet of society. The Disability Advocate Award honors an outstanding individual in Scottsdale who has demonstrated exceptional dedication to advocating for a person or persons with disabilities, says Kelsey Lamper, an operations supervisor at the City of Scottsdale who is focused on adaptive recreation. Whether a caregiver, educator, parent, guardian, volunteer, personal advocate, therapist, or business owner, this individual has made a profound impact by championing inclusion, accessibility, and equal opportunities for people with physical and neurodiversities. Nominations for the Disability Advocate Award should be submitted directly to Yvonne Cahill in Mayor Borowski's office, along with a description of why the nominee is deserving of this recognition. RSVPs for the event can be made to Isol Morales. Recipients will be recognized at the Mayor's Ability Awards ceremony from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday, April 18th at Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West, 3830 North Marshall Way in Scottsdale. Mayor's Ability Awards scholarships open for Scottsdale students. Eligible Scottsdale students who are planning to attend a college, university, vocational, or trade school can submit their applications from now until March 28. To ensure the best chance of success in completing the application, students are advised to seek assistance from their local academic counselor or transitional counselor. Detailed scholarship information and eligibility requirements for parents and participants are available at the city's website at scottsdaleaz.gov. Search Ability Awards. Assistance is available for those who may encounter difficulties completing the online application form. Please contact the mayor's office at 480 312-7977 for support. We are here to help make this year's Ability Awards the beginning of a new chapter in the celebration of the perseverance of those living and thriving with a disability here in Scottsdale. Ms. Cahill, who serves as Director of Constituent Services at the Office of Mayor Lisa Borowski, said, "We hope to see all of you there next month as we look forward to this Keystone Community event. Interested in being a scholarship sponsor of this event? Call Ms. Cahill at 480-312-7977. Now, here are some updates and activities from Ability 360. There's a construction notice. The Ability 360 Center property access will be limited to the Washington Street entrance starting January 9th through June 2025 due to underground water tank repair. The pool is opening on March 12, 2025. The hours of operation will be Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 7:30 p.m., Saturday, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. The pool is closed on Sunday. The Aquatic Center opens March 12th. Reservations will be required. Arizona Gives Day comes up April 1st, 2025. Give, grow, change. Find us at azgives.org. Donate now. Donations can go to either the 360 Outdoors Program or the George Bonhart Scholarship Fund, benefiting our annual Grand Canyon trip. Donate the gift of the great outdoors. Seeing Beyond Sight is an exciting program that empowers individuals with blindness or low vision to explore the world of sports, athletics, and creative expression. Through adaptive sports, hands-on experiences, and a variety of engaging activities, participants will gain new skills, build confidence, and connect with others in a supportive environment. You do not need to have low vision to participate. All are welcome to come to Seeing Beyond Sight to learn something new, meet new people, and have fun. It's free for members, $5 for non-members. Event dates Wednesdays from 4 to 5 p.m., March 5th to April 23rd. Event location, Ability 360 Fitness Center, East Court, 5031 East Washington, Phoenix, Arizona, 85034. You can sign up at the Ability 360 website. The 21st Annual American Indian Disability Summit will be held April 11, 2025. The annual American Indian Disability Summit provides an opportunity for American Indian consumers and families, caregivers, program staff, collaborators, and supporters to celebrate opportunities and support disability communities of friends and allies. The 2025 conference will be held at the Desert Willow Conference Center in Phoenix on Friday, April 11, 2025. Sign up for up to 10 participants is free. There's a $5 drop-in fee for non-members. You can register at the Ability 360 website. And now from the New York Times, Flo Fox, 79, dies. Street photographer overcame blindness and paralysis. She was legally blind and used a motorized wheelchair, but she managed to capture what she called the ironic reality of New York City on film. By Sam Roberts, published March 9, 2025. Flo Fox, an indomitable photographer who was born blind in one eye and who later lost her vision in the other from multiple sclerosis, which eventually paralyzed her from the neck down, but who never stopped shooting what she called the ironic reality of New York's streetscape, died on March 2nd at her home in Manhattan. She was 79. Her son and only immediate survivor, Ron Rittinger, said the apparent cause was complications of pneumonia. Inspired at 13 by a candid photograph of a street scene taken by Robert Frank, Ms. Fox asked her mother for a camera, but was told to wait until she finished high school. After graduating, she designed clothing for the theater and television commercials. It wasn't until she was 26 and had married, given birth, and been divorced that she finally got a camera, using her first paycheck to buy a Minolta from a costume design job. She stopped her design work after her multiple sclerosis advanced, incapacitating her hands and making it hard to work with clothing patterns, Mr. Rittinger said in an interview. Ms. Fox eventually survived mostly on Social Security and Medicaid. Over the next 5 decades, she took some 180,000 photographs, published a book, contributed to numerous publications, and exhibited her work at the Brooklyn Museum, the Smithsonian Institution, and galleries around the world, all despite being legally blind and dependent on a motorized wheelchair. In 2013, she was the subject of an op-doc video by the New York Times, directed by Riley Hooper. I always felt I had one great advantage being born blind in one eye and never having to close that eye while taking a picture, she told Viewfinder, the Leica Society International Journal, in 2022. I always didn't have to convert a three-dimensional view to a flat plane, since that was the way I automatically saw. All I had to do was frame the image perfectly. As the vision in her left eye faded, it was like looking through two stockings, she said. Ms. Fox switched to a 35mm autofocus camera. She initially released the shutter by pressing a rubber bulb in her mouth. Later, she enlisted help to shoot the pictures after she had framed the shot. She began photographing late in the day or at night to avoid glare that strained her eyes. By 1999, Ms. Fox was paralyzed from the neck down, but she continued to capture candid urban tableaus until her condition worsened in 2023. In a 2015 interview with the website Curbed New York, she described herself as a tourist every day in my own town. Photography is my existence, she wrote in an autobiographical sketch on her website. After missing a once-in-a-lifetime photo op, she said, she saw what she believed was a flying saucer hovering over Abingdon Square Park in Greenwich Village. She never went anywhere without her camera. In 1981, 69 of her black-and-white images of New York City in the 1970s were collected in Asphalt Gardens, a book published by the National Access Center. It described them as celebrating an indomitable human spirit struggling against a faceless system. Ms. Fox's work also appeared at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan, in Life magazine, and in several other books, including Women See Men and Women Photograph Men, both published in 1977, and Women See Women, 1978. In 1999, an exhibition of her photographs showed what it's like to be in a wheelchair much of the time. The collection was disseminated to encourage businesses and public officials to improve access for people with disabilities. Among Ms. Fox's favorite photographs were images looking down from the Flatiron Building and the original World Trade Center. She arranged several thematically, set them to music, and posted them on YouTube. Some of her photographs were whimsically titled. One called Everybody Sucks was an image of a driver sucking on a cigarette while a young girl in the back seat sucks her thumb. Another called Cover Girl shows a billboard with a scantily clad reclining model, her face obscured by a tarp as workmen labor below. Florence Blossom Fox was born on September 26, 1945, in Miami Beach, one of 4 children of Paul and Claire Bauer Fox. Her father had moved the family to Florida from New York City to open a honey factory. He died when Flo was 2, and her mother took the family back to Woodside, Queens. 12 years later, her mother died, and Flo went to live with an aunt and uncle on Long Island, where she attended General Douglas MacArthur High School in Levittown. "When I left home, I got my real education on the streets," she recalled in the Viewfinder interview. At age 18, marriage and motherhood came simultaneously. Plucky, 5'4", and largely self-taught, she was as gritty as her photographs. "You know my greatest loss when I became disabled? I can't even give people the finger anymore," she told the Daily News of New York in 2019. She hoped that her legacy would be that I was a tough chick, she said in 2015, a tough cookie. Other legacies, she hoped, would be helping to foster laws improving access for people with disabilities and to give voice to the ordinary New Yorkers she photographed. For over 30 years, Flo Fox photographed graffiti and any artwork that people left to sustain their memory, she wrote in her own eulogy, which she drafted about 15 years ago after learning that she had lung cancer. "Now in death, Flo requests that you leave your signature, initials, tag, or graffiti mark on her coffin." Some of those whose voices and visions she promoted never got to see their own artwork. Among them were her visually impaired students in a photography class at the Lighthouse, run by the New York Association for the Blind, now Lighthouse Guild. Those in the class wanted to know what they had encountered and what the view was out their bedroom windows, she recalled. They brought in photos they had taken, she added, and we then described all the colorful details to them. When one of her blind students offered a picture that he had taken from his bedroom, she told him, "There are trees outside your window." The man beamed. Next up, from the ARC, National disability rights organizations urge U.S. Supreme Court to protect rights of youth with disabilities in key education case. By Jackie Dilworth, published March 7, 2025. Washington, D.C. A coalition of national disability rights organizations is urging the U.S. Supreme Court to protect the civil rights of students with disabilities in AJT versus Osseo Area Schools, a landmark case that could determine how disability discrimination claims are handled in schools. In an amicus brief filed this week, these organizations, including the ARC, argue that students with disabilities should not face a higher legal standard when seeking justice for discrimination in schools, one that does not exist in other settings covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504. This case is about whether students with disabilities have to clear a higher legal hurdle to seek justice for discrimination in school, one that doesn't exist in workplaces, housing, or other settings, said Shira Wachschlag, Senior Director of Legal Advocacy and General Counsel at the ARC of the United States. "No child should have to fight an uphill battle just to hold their school accountable for discrimination. Schools must be held to the same standard as every other public entity, plain and simple." At the heart of the case is a legal standard applied in some courts that makes it much harder for students with disabilities to prove discrimination in school compared to other settings. Under this stricter rule, students must prove that their school acted with bad faith or gross misjudgment, a standard that does not apply in workplace, housing, or other discrimination claims under the ADA and Section 504. Decades ago, the Eighth Circuit Court created this higher standard for students in school settings, and since then, several other courts have followed. As a result, countless students with disabilities have had their claims rejected simply because they couldn't meet this excessive burden of proof. Disability rights advocates argue that this rule contradicts federal disability laws and makes it much harder for students to hold schools accountable when they face discrimination. It is imperative that we protect students' civil rights under Section 504 and the ADA for students who have suffered compensable harms from disability discrimination, said Celine Almazan, legal director at the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, COPAA. The legal rule whose demise is sought in this case, the bad faith or gross misjudgment standard, cannot be squared with the text or purposes of Section 504 and the ADA, which undergird protections for millions of children with disabilities attending K-12 schools. Families already struggle to secure the support and services their children need to thrive. This additional legal barrier only makes it harder for them to fight back when their rights are violated. The Supreme Court will hear oral argument on April 28, 2025. And now from the Washington Post, disabled Americans fear losing protections if state's lawsuit succeeds. By Amanda Morris, published March 11, 2025. Jennifer Cusera has a form of muscular dystrophy that limits her ability to move. Daily caregivers help her get out of bed, bathe, and dress. Without them, Cusera, 55, said she would be forced to live in an institution. She is one of millions of disabled Americans who rely on Medicaid for legally mandated services to remain integrated in society. An ongoing lawsuit challenges these legal mandates, leaving Cusera and others fearful that their services could be cut. "I'm basically fighting for my life," said Cusera of Berea, Ohio, who is also an advocate for the disabled community. "It's frightening because this lawsuit could affect everything." Texas versus Becerra was filed last year by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, Republican, in response to updated regulations in Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, a landmark federal law prohibiting disability discrimination. Section 504 specifically prohibits any entity receiving federal funds from discriminating against people with disabilities. The updated regulations focus mainly on ensuring equal access to medical treatments and websites, providing accessible communications, and integrating disabled people into society to the fullest extent possible. The preamble to the regulations includes an acknowledgement and agreement that gender dysphoria may, in some cases, be considered a disability under Section 504, based on a 2022 ruling from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit that reached the same conclusion. The lawsuit asks the court to prevent the new regulations from being enforced and to declare Section 504, 29 U.S.C. Section 794, unconstitutional. Many of the 17 attorneys general on the lawsuit have said they want to prevent the inclusion of gender dysphoria in the definition of disability and not to overturn Section 504 entirely. Despite the considerable misinformation about this lawsuit, the intent of this lawsuit was never to ask the court to declare all of Section 504 unconstitutional or to in any way reduce funding for disabled children and their families, South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley, Republican, wrote in an emailed statement. However, many disability advocates and legal experts said the lawsuit's text, as well as a subsequent joint report filed in late February, explicitly targets Section 504 and puts disabled people's legal protections at risk. They're using these mealy-mouthed, tricky phrasings to try and confuse people and mislead people to think that this is a narrow challenge, and it absolutely is not, said Claudia Center, legal director for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, a nonprofit law and policy organization focused on disability rights. Stated intent of lawsuit does not quell concerns. Center and other legal experts pointed out language from the lawsuit characterizing the Rehabilitation Act as coercive spending legislation that forces states to choose between complying and losing federal funding. Additionally, the joint filing states that the lawsuit's intent is to challenge any purported application of the law to funds that are not authorized by the Rehabilitation Act. This challenges nearly every area where the law is applied, such as schools, hospitals, and public transportation, said Allison Barkoff, a disability law expert and professor at George Washington University's Milken Institute School of Public Health, who worked for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights on the updated 504 regulations. Funding authorized by the Rehabilitation Act itself is very narrow, she said, and primarily supports state vocational rehabilitation programs and some employment programs. They did not change anything about the complaint. They did not drop the unconstitutional claim. They doubled down, she explained. This would be a complete change from how Section 504 has been applied for 50 years. When asked about the language in the lawsuit seeking to declare Section 504 unconstitutional, Louisiana Attorney General Liz Merle, Republican, wrote in an emailed statement that she did not support continuing with that particular part of the lawsuit and believes that the claim would be dropped. Others, such as Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr, Republican, denied assertions that the lawsuit was targeting Section 504. In an emailed statement, he wrote that the lawsuit was only about combating radical progressive transgender ideology. Paxton did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Disabled people fear institutionalization. Disabled people and advocates are worried that the true intent of the lawsuit is to weaken requirements on Medicaid funding to support home and community-based services, which people like Cusera rely on to stay out of institutions. States are required to give people Medicaid services in the most integrated setting appropriate to satisfy Section 504's non-discrimination mandate. This requirement is based on a 1999 Supreme Court decision called the Olmstead decision, which ruled that unnecessarily segregating people with disabilities into institutions was a form of discrimination. Subsequent courts affirmed the decision and ruled that putting people at risk of institutionalization was also discrimination. However, the lawsuit challenges these requirements based on a U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit decision that rejected the idea that a risk for institutionalization was discrimination, marking a split from most circuit court rulings on the issue, said Nicole Huberfeld, a health law professor at Boston University School of Law. The lawsuit characterizes integration requirements as regulatory burdens that impose substantial costs to states. Before the enactment of Section 504, hundreds of thousands of people with disabilities were institutionalized and not given opportunities to go to school or work. One was Veronica Ayala, 54, of Galveston, Texas, who was placed in an institution when she was 2 years old. Ayala has cerebral palsy, which causes motor difficulty and muscle weakness. To get treatments from the state, Ayala was institutionalized. Most little kids are tucked into bed every night by their parents. I wasn't, she remembered. It kind of severed something as far as bonding with my mother. Ayala lived for a few years in a state-run institution. Section 504 later allowed Ayala's family to get her Medicaid-funded physical therapy at home, she said. I'm going to take a quick break from the article to remind you that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now back to the article. If implementation of Medicaid services is left up to the states, Ayala fears that states will choose to institutionalize more people. If you don't say they have to do something, they won't, said Ayala, now a disability rights advocate. Even with the mandate now, they don't do a good job. In many states, disabled people face long wait lists to receive home and community-based Medicaid services, and some still end up in institutions where they can experience poor quality of care, neglect, and isolation. Beverly Levia, 70, said she was appalled at her 39-year-old son's treatment in an institution. After a brain injury in 2016, he is blind and a quadriplegic, and he struggles to speak. He lived in an institution for 1 year while Levia and her husband applied for the Medicaid services and accommodations he needed to come home. At times, her son was left in soiled diapers for hours, she said. The family eventually got Medicaid funding to install equipment such as an in-home lift and hire personal care aides who help her son with dressing, eating, and bathing. Without that type of help, I don't think we could do this, as much as we would want to, because we both also have our own medical issues, said Levia of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Shira Wachschlag, Senior Director of Legal Advocacy and General Counsel for the ARC, a national disability advocacy organization, rejected the idea that these services were too costly or burdensome and cited data showing that community-based services are cheaper than institutionalization. Wachschlag sees the lawsuit as part of a larger attack on Medicaid services, especially as Republicans weigh potential cuts to the program to meet goals of slashing up to $880 billion from the federal budget over 10 years. If there are cuts to Medicaid and the states prevail with their lawsuit, Wachschlag fears that states will stop providing some disability services altogether. Law professor Huberfeld and other experts believe that a ruling in the state's favor could set a precedent with the potential to affect other civil rights laws, such as Title VI, which bars racial discrimination, and Title IX, which bars sex-based discrimination, because they operate similarly to Section 504. The lawsuit, Huberfeld said, is about fighting the history of using federal funding to protect civil rights. I think states would say they want the money without the rules, but there's a long history of states using federal funding for the wrong purpose, so they need to put conditions on the funding. Currently, the lawsuit is on pause. The parties to the lawsuit have been ordered to file another joint status report no later than April 21st. Kucera remembers struggling with limited access before Section 504 was implemented, including being carried into places such as doctor's office by her parents. She fears losing the life she has built, living in her own apartment and having a job, if the lawsuit succeeds. Everything I've accomplished could be gone in an instant, she said. I can't even imagine that we might have to go back to a world like that. And now this piece from the March issue of the Braille Monitor. It's entitled, Leading Disability Organizations, President Trump's Blame of Deadly Plane Crash on Disabled Federal Workers is Baseless, Irresponsible. From the editor. The following press release was issued on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind and several other organizations of Americans with Disabilities. On January 21, 2025, the day after his inauguration, President Donald J. Trump issued an executive order entitled Keeping Americans Safe in Aviation, one of many such orders that purported to end diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, programs of the federal government. The order asserted that The prior administration sought to specifically recruit and hire individuals with serious infirmities that could impact the execution of their essential life-saving duties. It might have gone relatively unnoticed among the blizzard of similar announcements emanating from the Oval Office at the time, but tragic circumstances brought aviation to the forefront of the news on January 29, when a military helicopter and a commercial jet collided in midair at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, DCA. Sadly, no one survived the horrific crash, and 67 souls were lost. At a press conference the next morning, President Trump speculated that the hiring of workers with disabilities by the FAA might have led to the crash. Here is the response of some of America's leading disability organizations. For immediate release, January 30, 2025. Contact, Jess Davidson, jdavidson@aapd.com, 202-465-5528, Washington, D.C. In remarks today at the White House, President Trump cast potential blame for the tragic and deadly plane crash that occurred last night near Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport on people with disabilities employed by the Federal Aviation Administration. Soon after the president's comments, multiple news agencies reported that the air traffic control tower was understaffed at the time of the crash. Despite these reports, the White House has continued to double down on their baseless claims. In response, the American Association of People with Disabilities, American Council of the Blind, Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, United Spinal Association, National Federation of the Blind, and other leading disability rights organizations issue the following statement. The president's remarks today suggesting that the deadly crash of Flight 5342 may have been the fault of public servants with disabilities are irresponsible, disparaging, and wrong. It is extremely inappropriate for the president to use this tragedy as an opportunity to advance his anti-diversity hiring agenda. The focus of the federal government and the entire nation should be on the emergency response, a thorough investigation, and most of all, supporting the families and communities who lost their loved ones in this tragedy. People with disabilities proudly serve our nation through government service in every federal department and agency. Disabled employees, like non-disabled employees, are hired because they meet the qualifications needed to do the job. The Federal Aviation Administration has rigorous standards for hiring air traffic controllers and all other FAA employees. Diversity hiring initiatives seek to expand the pool of potential qualified talent for a role. They do not supersede the qualifications and skills that the role requires. The implication that people are being hired to do a job for which they are unqualified is an unfounded lie that further reinforces harmful stereotypes against disabled people. The president is deliberately spreading falsehoods to demonize the quarter of American adults who live with disabilities, rather than directing federal resources toward ensuring that such a devastating tragedy never happens again. This is part of a broader coordinated attack on civil rights and equal opportunity across government. These attacks do nothing to keep Americans safe and actually threaten our ability to ensure safety by building the strongest possible aviation workforce, said American Association of People with Disabilities President and CEO Maria Towne. Scott Thornhill, the executive director of the American Council of the Blind, stated, "The tragic accident that occurred last night near Reagan Washington National Airport is one we all are deeply saddened about. This is not a time for political posturing or speculation. Our thoughts and prayers are with the families of those who devastatingly lost their lives. We strongly denounce any insinuation that hiring individuals with disabilities had any part in this horrific event." One of the biggest factors keeping people with disabilities out of the workforce is baseless stigma around our ability to do our jobs. Despite ample data showing the capability and productivity of disabled workers, disclosing a disability still makes job applicants 26% less likely to even get a preliminary interview. Programs like the one President Trump attacked have been part of the federal government's work to eliminate that stigma. It is deeply disappointing to see our government now deciding instead to make it worse, said Colin Killick, the executive director of Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. The president's harmful speculation unfairly targets disabled workers and reinforces dangerous and baseless stereotypes, added Nicole Bond, executive director of the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Disability is not a liability, and these narratives only serve to fuel discrimination, exclusion, and stigma, particularly for disabled BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and People of Color, workers who already face compounded barriers in employment. Right now, the focus must be on supporting the families and communities affected by this tragedy and ensuring a fact-based investigation, not on scapegoating disabled people who belong in every workplace, including aviation and public safety. The cause of the terrible plane crash at DCA last night remains unknown, said Marlene Sallow, executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. Now is the time to thoroughly investigate what caused this accident and support the families who lost loved ones. It is not the time to blame or further stigmatize people with disabilities. Mark Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind, stated, "Blind Americans share in our nation's mourning for the lives lost in last night's tragic accident. We are shocked that the President of the United States would reinforce unfounded misconceptions of disability by codifying them in the Keeping Americans Safe in Aviation executive order. We know that people with disabilities are among the best and brightest. We also know that our focus today and in the days to come should be on the lives lost, not the misunderstanding of the lives of people with disabilities." The National Organization of Nurses with Disabilities, NOND, said, "NOND dramatically and strongly disagrees with the statement made by the federal administration that people with disabilities create unsafe conditions for others. The government's statement is appalling, dehumanizing, and blatantly discriminatory. NOND supports DEI, which is crucial to promoting the full inclusion of marginalized populations, including people with disabilities. Research indicates that with age, the incidence of disability and chronic health conditions increases. Disability is not about those of us who are disabled now, it is about our society at large. Blaming people with disabilities for the deadly crash at DCA is both misleading and deeply misguided. Individuals with disabilities are hired under already stringent standards due to existing biases, and when we secure employment, it is because we have clearly demonstrated our ability to perform the job with excellence," said United Spinal Association President and CEO Vincenzo Piscopo. "As a person with a disability myself, I can say without hesitation that I have proudly and consistently contributed value in every role I've held. To suggest otherwise is not only unfounded, but also undermines the contributions of millions of disabled professionals who excel in their fields every day." This statement is provided on behalf of the following organizations: American Association of People with Disabilities, American Council of the Blind, Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, Autistic Women and Non-Binary Network, Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law, Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, National Coalition for Mental Health Recovery, National Disability Rights Network, National Federation of the Blind, National Organization of Nurses with Disabilities, Not Dead Yet. This next article comes from Nature. It's entitled, Artificial Intelligence Could Boost Eye Care in Low-Income Countries. Technology rivals ophthalmologists in detecting diabetic retinopathy, allowing more people to be screened globally. By Tammy Wirth. Published March 5, 2025. In October, after almost a decade of work, Google licensed its artificial intelligence, AI, model for detecting the eye disease diabetic retinopathy to three healthcare technology companies, two in India and one in Thailand. It came with a condition. The firms have to provide 6 million free AI screenings to people in low and middle-income countries, LMICs, over the next 10 years. They will be setting up their own business models, but on the side, they will also be delivering screenings to people who need it the most but can't afford it, said Sunny Vermani, project manager at Google Health in Mountain View, California. Blindness from diabetic retinopathy is completely preventable, and the fact that we have not been able to do effective screening in some of these places shouldn't be forgiven. Of the 43 million people in the world who are blind or visually impaired, almost 90% live in LMICs. There are many social and economic issues that contribute to this. Living in rural communities can hinder people's ability to access health care, and a lack of health literacy can lead some people to think that blindness is a normal and untreatable consequence of aging. Low-income countries also have only 3 or 4 ophthalmologists per 1 million people. In high-income countries, the number is about 76 per 1 million people. Using AI to screen for and diagnose eye conditions such as glaucoma, age-related macular degeneration, and diabetic retinopathy could help to lower the burden of visual impairment. Research suggests that the technology reduces the need for specialists, makes care more accessible, and improves adherence to follow-up visits. But the real-world cost of AI screening remains uncertain, and hiccups encountered during the deployment of these tools could reduce their effectiveness. Ophthalmology is primed for the use of diagnostic AI technology. There is lots of imaging data that has been collected for many years as a routine practice, and that data is perfect for training AI models, says Charles Cleland, an ophthalmologist and researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. A growing need. For some conditions, AI diagnosis is unlikely to move the needle. AI-assisted screening for diabetic retinopathy, however, could be of considerable benefit. Diabetes is becoming more common in LMICs. By 2045, it is estimated that more than 21 million adults in sub-Saharan Africa will be affected, up from fewer than 9 million in 2019. Diabetic retinopathy develops when excess sugar in the blood damages blood vessels, which causes fluid to leak into the eye. This can cause changes in vision, such as sudden color blindness or night blindness, floating spots, and blurring. Eventually, a person could become blind, but early diagnosis and treatment reduces this risk by about 98%. Surgery is required only at the most advanced stages of diabetic retinopathy. Before that, the condition can be treated with injections of corticosteroids or antivascular endothelial growth factor, anti-VEGF drugs, or with laser treatments that can reduce retinal swelling and stop blood loss in the eye. These are not straightforward to deliver in LMICs. Anti-VEGF drugs must be administered repeatedly in the clinic through injections into the eye, for example. However, if the disease is caught early enough, then simple treatments to manage a person's blood glucose levels can slow progression, or even prevent a person with diabetes from developing eye problems in the first place. Proven technology. In 2014, Dale Webster, director of research at Google Health, and his colleagues began to test AI's capacity to diagnose disease from medical images. Researchers had just demonstrated that AI image recognition systems can classify breeds of cats and dogs in images better than humans could. One of Webster's colleagues was a family friend of ophthalmologist R. Kim, director of Arvind Eye Hospital in Madura, India. When Kim mentioned that one of the hospital's main challenges was a lack of specialists to quickly assess a person's eyes for signs of diabetic retinopathy, the researchers realized that AI could help. The team spent a couple of years developing a system known as Automated Retinal Disease Assessment, ARDA, that could diagnose the disease as effectively as ophthalmologists in a laboratory setting. To diagnose diabetic retinopathy, physicians and algorithms alike analyze the interior of the back of the eye, known as the fundus. ARDA ingests one image from each eye taken by a specialist camera, which Webster says costs about $10,000. Use of these cameras is straightforward and does not require an ophthalmologist. The technology seems to be at least as good as ophthalmologists at diagnosing retinopathy. Between 2018 and 2020, the Google team, in collaboration with Paisan Ruamvebunsik, an ophthalmologist at Rajavithi Hospital in Bangkok, and his colleagues, screened 7,651 people in three regions of Thailand. Around 30% were subsequently referred to specialists for either diabetic retinopathy or diabetes-related macular edema, or, based on a separate test, poor vision. For diabetic retinopathy that threatened vision, either early stage but severe disease or later stage disease with blood vessels growing on the retina, ARDA achieved an accuracy of 94.7%. This study was a major milestone in providing evidence that these tools are safe and effective, Webster says. The next important step is to enable doctors to use it in their current workflows to screen more people so that fewer cases are missed and fewer people go blind. Although Thailand has a national screening program for diabetes, only about 50% of people with diabetes are assessed for eye disease. That is, in part, because of a lack of trained staff. AI screening tools could help to boost efficiency. A 2023 study of an eye clinic in Bangladesh found that physicians could see about 920 people in about 7 weeks. When clinic staff used an autonomous AI diagnosis system called Luminetics Core, developed by Digital Diagnostics in Coralville, Iowa, 1,189 people were screened over a similar period. Another challenge with diabetic retinopathy in LMICs is getting people to a specialist after they are diagnosed. In some low-resource settings, it can take weeks to get images evaluated and graded on a scale of disease severity, and for the results to be returned to an individual. A small study led by Cleland in Tanzania in 2016 found that after this length of time, only about 25% of people attended their recommended follow-up appointments. In low-resourced settings, patients are there to receive care. It's hard to ask them to come back again when they have so many other competing issues, says Jennifer Patnick, an epidemiologist at the University of Colorado School of Medicine in Aurora. She and her colleagues demonstrated that using AI screening to deliver immediate results to people with diabetic retinopathy in Rwanda could increase the number of people accessing follow-up care. Around half of those who received results from the CyberSight AI system took up their recommended referral to a specialist straight away, 30% more than when people were made to wait just 3 to 5 days for a person to grade the images. Real-world challenges. Several issues will have to be addressed before AI can be adopted broadly for ophthalmic purposes in LMICs. Some details are minor, such as training staff. Another pain point has been slow or interrupted internet connections, a frequent occurrence in LMICs. Delaying the upload or receipt of results from cloud servers on which most of the programs run. Reliance on the cloud also brings legal problems. In Tanzania, for example, it's against the law for clinical data to be transferred outside the country without a data transfer agreement, so the images can't easily be processed by an AI system that is housed in another country. Besides all these obstacles, however, sits another very significant one: cost. So far, tests of AI screening in LMICs have been funded mainly as part of clinical trials, and there aren't many data on what it will cost to provide this technology in the real world. A few studies suggest that AI could be slightly cheaper than conventional screening for diabetic retinopathy. A study based in rural China calculated that AI screening costs $180.19 per person, compared with $215.05 per person for screening by an ophthalmologist. And a study of retinopathy screening programs in Singapore found that a semi-automated model costs $62 per person per year, cheaper than both a physician-based approach, $77, and a fully autonomous AI, $66. But any cost difference varies with the accuracy of AI. False positives are costly, and the price of physician labor in different communities. Although AI has a lot of potential for screening and diagnostics, it cannot reduce the burden of visual impairment in LMICs alone. There are lots of other issues that need to be addressed as well, Cloen said. Access to treatment will be crucial to making the most of whatever gains AI screening delivers. Getting diagnosed doesn't mean that a person isn't going to lose vision, Cloen said, but he adds, improving diagnostics will help. And with that, we have run out of time. Thanks for joining us for the Disability News Program. Please join us again next time.